Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, I want you to start by just imagining you are standing in the middle of a really busy shopping mall, or, maybe just scrolling through a perfectly curated social media feed.
Right, something very typical.
Yeah, exactly. It's loud, it's bright, everyone looks busy, everyone is buying things, and suddenly, right in the middle of all that noise, you get this overwhelming, sinking feeling. Like, is this it? Is this actually all there is to being alive?
It's a heavy thought.
It is.
Yeah.
And if you have ever had that moment, that sudden drop in your stomach, you aren't just having a bad day. You are stumbling right into the territory we are covering today. Existentialism.
Which is really the perfect setting for this discussion, because when people hear existentialism, they usually think of, French guys in black turtlenecks smoking cigarettes.
Looking very sad and brooding.
Exactly. But we aren't talking about a fashion statement or a mood. We're talking about the roots of a philosophy that isn't even really a formal system. It's a specific focus of interest on human existence.
Right.
It's the study of what it actually feels like to be a self-conscious individual stuck in a broken and often really confusing world.
It's philosophy with a pulse, basically. It's deeply personal. And to navigate this today, we are looking at two absolute titans of the 19th century, Søren Kierkegaard and Friedrich Nietzsche. Talk about an odd couple.
They really, really are. I mean, on paper, you couldn't find two people who disagree more. In one corner, you have Kierkegaard, who is this earnest, deeply religious, Orthodox, Lutheran
And
Christian.
in the other corner.
Nietzsche, the guy who famously declared God is dead
Yeah.
and basically appointed himself the Antichrist. You just couldn't be further apart theologically.
And yet, when you look at the source material, they seem to be fighting the exact same enemy.
Yeah,
They're
no.
like two guys shooting at the same target from opposite sides of the field.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. They were both railing against the dry, passionless, systematized culture of their time. They both looked at their neighbors, the respectable middle class, and realized everyone was just sleepwalking. They both saw a profound crisis of the human spirit.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack how these two opposing thinkers diagnosed that exact crisis. We're going to look at the battle between the subjective and the objective, why logic completely fails to answer life's biggest questions, and ultimately, how they thought we could wake up. So let's start with Kierkegaard.
Let's do it.
So, as we said, he's a religious philosopher. Now, if I'm a betting person and I hear Christian philosopher, I just assume his work is about proving God exists. You know the drill, look at the trees, look at the complexity of the eye.
Look at the historical records, right?
Right. Here's the evidence, QED, God is real.
You would think so. That is what we call natural theology, or the objective path. But Kierkegaard, he absolutely hates that approach.
Wait, really?
Oh, completely.
Right.
In fact, he thinks that trying to prove God exists actually destroys faith.
Hold on, how does proving something exists destroy faith? Wouldn't that make it easier?
Well, that's the trap. Kierkegaard distinguishes between two paths, the objective path and the subjective path. The objective path is exactly what you just described, trying to use history, logic, or science to build a case.
Okay.
Kierkegaard argues this path is a dead end for two big reasons. First, it's always incomplete. You can always say, well, let me just wait for a little more data before I decide.
Ah, so it allows you to sit on the fence forever. You just treat God like a scientific hypothesis.
Exactly. It becomes an intellectual exercise rather than an actual life choice. But there is a deeper, more technical problem here, specifically regarding Christianity. The central claim of Christianity is the incarnation.
The idea that the eternal, infinite God entered into time and became a finite human being.
Right. Which, if you think about it logically,
Which is total contradiction.
it's not just a contradiction, it is an impossibility within the laws of logic. Because logic relies on neutral premises, usually empirical laws about how the world works. Like, humans are finite, God is infinite, A cannot be B.
Right, basic rules.
But the incarnation, by definition, breaks those laws. It's a completely unique historical event. Kierkegaard argues there are no neutral, objective premises you can use to prove an event that literally defies the rules of the universe.
So you're saying you can't use the laws of physics to prove a miracle that breaks the laws of physics?
Precisely. Kierkegaard says the intellect just hits a brick wall here, and he calls this wall the unknown. He actually draws on a scene from the Book of Acts in the Bible to explain this.
Oh, the Paul and Athens story.
Yes. The Apostle Paul is in Athens, which is the absolute center of logic and philosophy at the time. He sees all these temples to Zeus and Apollo, but he stands up and says, "I see you have an altar to the unknown God. That is who I am preaching."
I love that image. The intellect takes you to the edge of the cliff, but it just can't build the bridge to the other side.
It takes you to what Kierkegaard calls the paradox. This is the absolute core of his theology, the idea that the eternal and the finite actually met. Now, we really have to remember the context here. Kierkegaard was writing against the backdrop of Hegel.
Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. The thesis, antithesis, synthesis guy?
The very one. The 19th century was completely obsessed with Hegel. And Hegel loved tidy resolutions. You have a thesis, you have an opposing antithesis, and they merge into a nice, comfortable synthesis.
Everything gets wrapped up in a bow.
Right. It's a very rational, progressive view of history. Everything gets worked out eventually through logic.
And Kierkegaard looked at the messy reality of life and said, yeah, I don't think so.
Exactly. He looked at the incarnation and said, there is no synthesis here. You can't just merge the eternal and the finite into a smooth, logical concept. It stays a paradox. And interestingly, the source material points out that this was even more intense for Kierkegaard because he was a Lutheran.
Oh, really? How does the specific denomination change the philosophy?
It's a fascinating nuance of theology. In Lutheran theology, the divine attributes and the human attributes of Christ don't mix easily. They're like oil and water. If he had been Reformed or Presbyterian, those theologies talk about the interpenetration of attributes, God's infinite wisdom and man's finite wisdom meeting on sort of a sliding scale. It's much smoother. But for a Lutheran, the gap between God and man is absolute. Infinite versus finite, full stop.
So if the gap is absolute and logic completely fails and there is no Hegel synthesis, what is left? I mean, it sounds like we're just stuck.
We aren't stuck, but we are forced to stop thinking and start believing. This brings up his concept of the absurd. Kierkegaard connects with the ancient theologian Tertullian, who famously said, I believe because it is absurd.
Which just sounds crazy to a modern ear. Like, I believe it because it makes absolutely no sense.
Right. But he doesn't mean it's just gibberish. He's using absurd as a limiting concept. It's a term he borrowed from Immanuel Kant. It means the objective path brings you to the absolute limit of what a human brain can process. You see the paradox. You realize you can't solve it like a math equation. So you have a choice. You either turn back or you take the leap.
And that leap is the subjective path. You have to stop calculating and start existing.
Correct. And this brings us to one of his most famous contributions, Stages on Life's Way. Kierkegaard believed there are three main stages of existence that a person navigates: the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious.
Okay, let's break these down because I think a lot of listeners will instantly recognize themselves in these. Stage one, the aesthetic. Now, in modern internet slang, aesthetic just means, you know, your room looks cool on Instagram, but he means something deeper than that.
It does. He's using the classical definition relating to sense perception. The aesthetic stage is the sensate life. It's living for immediate pleasure, for the senses.
So art, music, food.
Yes, but also materialism, shopping, romance, social climbing. It's life without any deep moral anchor.
The source material used a really great analogy for this, the town square.
Yes, the shopping center analogy.
Yeah.
Imagine walking around a high-end mall. You see all these stores filled with bottles. Now, maybe the bookstore has some utility, maybe the grocery store.
Yeah.
But everything else, it's just stuff.
Just shiny things designed to catch your eye.
Exactly. Kierkegaard says this environment caters to a sensate culture.
But it feels good in the moment, though. I mean, buying the shoes feels good. Getting the likes feels good.
For a moment, sure. But Kierkegaard asks, what is the actual result? If your whole life is just chasing the next sensory input, the next dopamine hit, it eventually leads to boredom. And then something much worse, melancholy. He uses a very heavy phrase here, hysteria of the spirit.
Wow, hysteria of the spirit. That sounds like a panic attack.
It's the profound realization that your spirit is dispersed in a thousand little distractions. You aren't a unified self at all. You're just a bundle of consumer impulses. You're completely fragmented. And this crisis, this feeling of intense emptiness amidst all the plenty, pushes you to the next stage, the ethical.
Which I assume is where you finally grow up and become a responsible adult.
Essentially, yes. You stop just chasing fun. You get married, you accept civic duties, you run for the school board, you follow the rules.
You become a respectable member of society.
Right. It's a very Kantian existence. You do things because it is your duty. You become the good citizen.
That sounds fine. That's what we tell people to do. Be responsible. Pay your taxes.
It is fine. Kierkegaard isn't saying it's inherently bad,
but
he says it has a hard ceiling. You could be a perfect citizen, following all the rules perfectly, but you do it without any deep passion or moral anguish. It just becomes dry. You're just ticking boxes.
And that leads to another crisis.
Yes. The sickness unto death.
Sickness unto death. He really loved the dramatic phrasing.
He really did. But it means the spirit is still dying. It's still hungry for something absolute. And this forces the final leap to the religious stage. But Kierkegaard, being Kierkegaard, complicates it. He distinguishes between religious A and religious B.
Of course he does. What is the difference?
Religious A is basically just the ethical stage dressed up in church clothes.
Ah.
It's institutional Christianity. You sit in the pew, you sing the hymns, you follow the religious rules, because that's what good people do. It's safe. It's totally respectable.
And religious B.
That is the vital spiritual life. That is the actual encounter with the paradox. And to get there, Kierkegaard talks about the teleological suspension of the ethical.
Okay, that is a mouthful. Let's unpack that for everyone.
Telos means purpose or end goal. He's talking about suspending the ethical rules for a higher purpose. The classic example he uses is Abraham being asked to sacrifice his son Isaac. Now, ethically, that is murder. It is wrong. It breaks every single rule of the ethical stage.
Right.
But religiously, it is an act of absolute trust in God. Abraham has to suspend the ethical rules to encounter the divine directly.
That is terrifying. It completely removes the safety net of just following the rules. It sounds like it requires a massive amount of emotion to even attempt something like that.
It requires passion. And we really need to clarify that word, because today passion usually means romance or something X-rated. Kierkegaard is using the 18th century psychological definition coming from thinkers like David Hume.
Right. So what does it mean in that context?
Passion means the emotions, the dispositions, the non-cognitive heart of the inner life. It's your deep driving force.
The source had a metaphor about ice that I thought really nailed this difference between the objective thinker and the passionate believer.
The ice analogy is brilliant. Kierkegaard critiques his own era, the Enlightenment, as being completely passionless.
Yeah.
He says, imagine a jewel lying out on a sheet of thin ice.
Okay.
The Enlightenment thinker, the objective man, stands safely on the shore. He calculates the thickness of the ice, the exact temperature, the risk factors, the probability of drowning. He knows everything about the ice.
But he never actually gets the jewel.
Right. He is entirely paralyzed by his own calculation. But the passionate person, they just skate out to get it. They might drown. It's incredibly dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But they act. Kierkegaard felt the Enlightenment produced people who were absolute experts at calculating, but totally incapable of acting.
There was another great image in the sources, too, the Lover's Handbook.
Oh, this is classic Kierkegaard. He mocks the idea of a man trying to woo a woman by reading from a phrase book. Just imagine a guy on a date, hiding a book under the table, looking up approaching a romantic interest in the index, and reading the lines robotically.
I find you very appealing.
Exactly. It's technically correct, but it's completely void of the spontaneity and passion that makes love real. If you are reading the manual, you aren't actually in the relationship. Kierkegaard says most people treat God exactly like that. They read the manual, but they never fall in love.
And this distinction between calculating and being leads to his final separation, the genius versus the apostle.
Right. This is how he differentiates human brilliance from divine authority.
Mm.
A genius is someone creative, someone who really stands out. But ultimately, a genius is just a human being. They're just part of the evolution of human thought. Einstein was a genius. He moved the needle of science. Beethoven was a genius.
But an apostle isn't just a religious genius.
No. An apostle is qualitatively different. An apostle doesn't say, hey, I have a bright idea. An apostle says, thus saith the Lord. They speak with an authority that comes from beyond history. It's not an evolution of thought. It's a revelation.
So it's a completely different category.
Exactly. Kierkegaard wants us to stop admiring the genius of the Bible. You know, people saying, oh, Jesus was such a great moral teacher, and start submitting to the authority of the apostle.
So Kierkegaard is trying to save the individual by getting them to stop calculating, stop just being a good citizen, and take a passionate leap of faith into the absurd. But now we have to pivot, because at the exact same time, we have another guy trying to save the individual by destroying faith entirely.
Friedrich Nietzsche.
The man, the myth, the mustache. Usually people just know him as the God is dead guy. But looking at the research, he's not just an atheist. He seems to be doing something much more specific.
Much more. If Kierkegaard is a religious existentialist, Nietzsche is a naturalist and a vitalist. When Nietzsche says God is dead, he isn't just making a theological statement. He is making a cultural diagnosis.
What exactly is the diagnosis?
He's looking closely at 19th century Victorian culture. Think of Queen Victoria. Everyone dressed in black, very repressed, very proper. He argues that God language has become a dead language, People still went to church. They still used the words. But the concepts didn't vibrate with any life anymore.
They were just going through the motions.
Right. The culture acted as if God was there, but lived without any real vitality.
So he thinks Christianity is actually killing the human spirit.
He thinks it says no to life. He argues that Christianity blames the flesh, it hides sexuality, and it treats the physical world as something to be overcome or something to be ashamed of. Nietzsche wants to say yes. He wants the ancient pagan, yes, the ultimate affirmation of nature, strength, power, and virility.
Now, this is where it gets surprising. You'd think if he loves nature and strength so much, he would love Charles Darwin. Survival of the fittest sounds very Nietzsche. But he actually hated Darwin. Why?
This is a really crucial distinction. Darwin talks about adjustment to the environment. Organisms survive by fitting in, by adapting to their surroundings to stay safe. Nietzsche looked at that and said, that's pathetic. He says that process just produces well-adjusted doodlers.
Well-adjusted doodles. That is a scathing insult coming from a philosopher.
He doesn't want adjustment. He wants overcoming. He doesn't want us to just fit into the environment. He wants us to conquer it. This is his concept of the will to power. It's voluntarism. The idea that the fundamental reality of the universe isn't matter or logic. It is will, drive, raw energy.
So if we aren't supposed to be doodlers and we aren't supposed to be Christians, what are we supposed to be? How do we handle all the suffering of life?
We are supposed to embrace the tragic nature of life. Nietzsche actually goes back to the Greeks for this. In his book, The Birth of Tragedy, he talks about two competing forces, the Apollonian and the Dionysian.
Apollo and Dionysus.
Right. Apollo represents form, rational order, light, sculpture. Dionysus represents vitality, chaos, intoxication, wine, and music. Nietzsche says the true greatness of Greek tragedy was that it fused these two together.
How so?
It creatively affirmed life, even in the face of the horrible. It didn't try to hide from the dark, painful stuff like the Victorians did. It turned the darkness into art.
And this leads to his famous and frankly very controversial view on morality. Master morality versus servant morality. Now, keeping in mind we are just exploring his perspective here. What is the difference?
Right. Well, you have to brace yourself for this one. Nietzsche believes that historically there was a master morality. This was the morality of the strong, the noble, the conquerors. They defined good as things that were strong and life-affirming. Bad was just being weak or ineffective.
But then something changed.
Yes. The weak will of the masses couldn't compete with the strong. So Nietzsche argues they invented a brand new system, slave morality. And this is where he introduces the concept of resentment.
Resentment? It sounds like resentment, but I'm guessing it's more specific.
It is subconscious revenge. Nietzsche argues that weak people invented values like humility, altruism, and pity, specifically to shackle the strong. It's a way of saying, you might be stronger than me, but I am good because I am weak and humble, and you are evil because you are powerful.
That is deeply cynical. He's saying kindness isn't actually kindness. It's just a weapon used by weak people to drag everyone else down.
He calls it subconscious aggression against oneself. If I feel guilty, that is just me attacking myself because I'm too weak to attack the world. He viewed the Christian ethic of turning the other cheek as a brilliant subconscious strategy by the weak to completely neutralize the strong. It's sour grapes on a civilizational scale.
So if we strip all that away, if we kill God, reject slave morality, and reject Darwinian adjustment, what is actually left for Nietzsche?
The Übermensch.
The Superman.
Or the Overman. The translation varies a bit. But the core idea is a new kind of human who is completely broken free from the herd morality. Someone who creates their own values. Someone who looks at a world without God, a world full of pain and suffering, and says yes to it anyway. Someone who makes their life a work of art.
It's a lot to take in, but if we step back, we have these two massive figures. Kierkegaard says, the system is broken, logic is a dead end, take a passionate leap of faith. And Nietzsche says, the system is broken, God is dead, use your will to create your own meaning.
That is the perfect synthesis. They are total opposites. One is heading toward the cross, the other is heading toward the will to power. But they are strangely connected. They both fiercely rejected the objective, dry, rational systems of their day. They both hated the doodlers.
They both demand that you stop floating.
Exactly. They both focused intensely on the individual spirit. They both demand passion. They both said that just existing isn't enough. You have to actively choose how to exist.
It really challenges you to look at your own life. It is very easy to be a well-adjusted doodler in the modern world. Yeah. I mean, we have more baubles in our town squares than Kierkegaard could have ever imagined. We have algorithms to do our calculating for us. We have systems to tell us what is ethical.
And that makes their core question even more relevant today. Are you skating out on the ice, or are you just standing safely on the shore calculating the risk? Are you creating your own path, or are you just adjusting to the environment?
And that's the question we want to leave you with today. We live in a world that is obsessed with data, with objective facts, with optimizing your life. But if these two thinkers are right, logic and optimization just can't get us to the deepest truths of our existence. So what passion or will is actually driving your decisions? Are you just living a life of ethical duty, ticking boxes? Or have you found a way to bridge the gap?
It really is the only question that matters.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll see you next time.